It is the busiest shopping day of the year here in St. Louis, Missouri, and all across the Fruited Plain and everywhere else through the United States. Yes, it's the day after Thanksgiving. And hello, I am Paul Harris. Thank you for listening. Thank you for helping to spread the word that, yes, there is finally something to listen to in the middle of the day here in the middle of America. And, of course, it's only on the radio station we call the Blowtorch, the Big 550 KTRS. Hope you had a great Thanksgiving. I'm at home enjoying my long holiday weekend with my family, and so we're doing a Best of Paul Harris show for you today. That's why we're not doing a Harris Challenge now. That will return on Monday. Also on Monday, we'll start giving away those Billy Joel tickets. You can email your entry for that to billyjoel@harrisonline.com. And on Monday, we'll start calling out names and giving away those tickets for Billy's show 2 weeks from today at the Kiel Center. In this Best of Hour, we've got Jay Leno's wife, Mavis Leno, who's got a great humanitarian cause. She told me about it about 5 or 6 weeks ago, and we're going to replay that segment for you in just a moment. And then we'll meet Bernie Brillstein, who has a new book out called Where Did I Go Right? You're no one in Hollywood unless someone wants you dead. He has managed some of the big comedy talent of the last couple of decades, including John Belushi and the Saturday Night Live gang and a bunch of others. And he's got some great stories to share with you. All that coming up as we roll through another hour of the Best of Paul Harris here on the Big 550 KTRS.
To start the show today, a gentleman by the name of Bernie Brillstein. Bernie is a legendary agent, manager, and movie producer in Hollywood who kind of lived the Hollywood success dream. He started his career in 1955 in the mailroom of William Morris and went on to be one of the most powerful and, I think, most popular agents and managers in Hollywood. And now, after 4.5 decades in show business, he has written his memoir called Where Did I Go Right? You're No One in Hollywood Unless Someone Wants You Dead, which is one of the great book titles of this year. Good morning, Bernie. How are you?
Good morning. Well, I'm out buying Viramax for myself.
So well, good.
Okay.
Well, you know, after 45 years in the business...
I need something.
Well, maybe you do. Not only do you have one of the great book titles of the year, but you've got quite a showbiz life that we can talk about here.
Sure.
Just name for me some of the famous people for whom you've been an agent or a manager.
Jim Henson and the Muppets. Lorne Michaels, who created Saturday Night Live. John Belushi, Gilda Radner, Dan Aykroyd. Chevy Chase. My company represents Nick Cage, Brad Pitt, Christian Slater. We produced The Sopranos, Just Shoot Me, Politically Incorrect. Pretty interesting stuff.
Absolutely. Now, tell me before we start talking about the individual personalities, what does a manager do in Hollywood? What does a personal manager do for a client? What's your job?
Just to make it simple, an agent is licensed by the state to get people employment. A manager supposedly does everything else, advises, consults, sets the arena for a person to succeed, and basically is not supposed to get someone work. I have a big wink going when I say that, because if you don't help get someone work, you're not going to be a manager for long.
Right. So does that mean that you have to be a manager who goes to an agent and says, hey, we've got this great project, put this together?
No, we put it together, and then we go to the agent and say, please sell it, because we're supposedly not allowed to do it.
Now, how does that work with a client? Do they come to you with an idea for a show, or do you sit down with...
It's different today than it used to be. I mean, today, we're a studio. I mean, like Warner Brothers or 20th Century Fox,
yep.
Brillstein Gray is a production company that has backing by Columbia Pictures to hire writers who are supposedly the best in the business. And every once in a while, we have our own idea, and every once in a while, a client of ours has an idea. So wherever it comes from, we try to put it together with the best people and therefore get the best product.
Now, when you're talking about talent coming to you, do they actually come to you and say, Bernie, I want you to manage me, I want you to represent me, I want you to help me with my career, or do you have to go out and discover people?
Well, in most cases, you go out and not only discover people, which is the best part of the job. I mean, that's been the most fun I've ever had. But let's take someone like Marty Short right now. I'm producing his television show. I chased Marty for 4 years ago, because I thought he was the best talent in the business. And I finally got him. And then I had an idea for him to do this talk show. And then I sold it. And then Marty asked me to produce it.
Uh-huh.
So my wife, Carrie, said to me, now I actually know what you do. You pursue someone. You get them. You have an idea for them. You sell it. You then put it together. And then you have a lot of fun producing it. And it's really that simple, although it takes a lot of experience to do that.
I would guess after a lot of years in the business, people pick up the phone when you're calling them and you say, hey, I got Marty Short for a talk show. Okay, well, now we can talk.
Right. Well, I tell you, there are 20 people in Hollywood and New York you need to get on the phone. That's about it.
Only 20?
I say the guys who can say make a decision, say yes or no. And there aren't a lot of those guys. I don't know how it is in the radio business. But, I mean, you have a station manager, right?
Yes.
He's the guy who can say yes or no.
Right.
And that's it. There's no one else there you have to influence unless the station owner likes you or dislikes you.
So when Entertainment Weekly comes out with their list of the top 100 most powerful people in Hollywood, 80 of those people don't really matter?
Well, you're talking about guys like Malone and Sumner Redstone. You know, you don't call them. You call their operating head.
Uh-huh.
You know, so, Michael Eisner, you used to be able to get on the phone. I agree with you. I think most of them don't affect my daily life in selling people.
You mentioned a moment ago that the best part is discovering people and bringing them into your stable. Who have you discovered, and how did you find out about them?
Well, Jim Henson, who I think is probably the best. I don't know if you remember Kukla, Fran, and Ollie.
I do. As a kid, used to watch
right.
them all the time.
Right. Bert Tilstrom. When I was at William Morris, I got Bert Tilstrom a commercial. And he then called me up and said, Bernie, I want you to meet this puppeteer. And at the time, all I was interested in was straight comedy. And I said, Bert, I don't want any puppeteer. I really don't like it, you know. And he said, please do me a favor. And I said, okay. Which is something you also learn, to say okay to people who have talent.
Mm-hmm.
If they recommend something, they're usually pretty good. And into my office was this 6'4" guy with a beard wearing a leather suit, and he had this sample case, and he took out this box of wondrous puppets, and he worked them a different way than I'd ever seen them. One arm in the head and one arm in the arm, and they actually look real. And I, for some reason, I think it's God gave me a little message, you better be involved with this guy. And I did, and we had 30 years together till he passed away.
And the Muppets still thrive today? They just came out
The Muppets are being run by Brian Henson. They still thrive today, yes.
And they just came out with an Elmo movie recently that's
right.
doing pretty well with the
They're
kids.
They're doing great, and they constantly do commercials. They do foreign television shows. I mean, they're just a great company. And what's the best thing, if you walk into their creature shop where you actually see the creatures being built, it's an amazing experience.
Now, when you're managing a puppeteer, do you get to know the characters? I mean, the Kermit, Miss Piggy, Elmo.
That's a great setup. I actually said I was on the board of directors of the Muppets.
Yep.
And in my perverted mind, I always thought when I went into a board meeting, there'd be Kermit at the head of the table, Miss Piggy on the left, Elmo on the right. It was just my own joke with myself. You
right,
know?
Yeah.
You get to know. Here's what they do. If you have 2 seconds.
Yeah. I got plenty of time here, Bernie. I got a whole radio show. Go ahead.
Okay. The puppeteers actually write out a bio of what the character should be. And then no matter what happens, they live up to those characterizations, which is real interesting, I think.
And do the people who are, pardon me for putting it this way, putting their hands up the butt of the puppet, do they actually change personality as they become each of these characters?
Without a doubt. Frank Oz, who is the straightest and now a great movie director, when you see him underneath the stage, they work backwards to the television monitor. When you see him doing Miss Piggy, it's one of the great things in the world because he's the straightest guy who becomes Miss Piggy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's wonderful.
Must be very, very odd to be there in person and see that.
Well, let me tell you, it is odd to see people, as you say, put hands up the butt of a person. And then the next thing, the felt, which is the puppet, comes to life on camera. It's an amazing thing.
Kind of a metaphor for what you do as a manager, isn't
That's
it?
That's correct. I wheel them, put my hands up their butt, send them out to act. and make sure they don't get in too much trouble.
Right. Now, let's talk about the early days of Saturday Night Live, which you write about at length in the book. Were you there from the very beginning before?
I was there before anything. I mean, I was there with Lorne Michaels, who created the show, from a simple idea. He came to me and said, I want to do a television show for people who are brought up on television. That's 1975. And I thought it was such a great idea because no one had done that. And he assembled this group of wonderful Second City and Groundlings performers who no one had ever heard of, and that was not ready for primetime players. And in some mysterious way, we sold it to NBC. I don't think they knew what they were getting.
Now, when you went to NBC and told them, we want to do this thing, we want to take over the Best of Carson slot on Saturday night, because that's what they were running in that 11:30 Saturday night time slot, and NBC didn't really quite know what Lorne was doing or who these people were.
They didn't pay any attention to it. Herb Schlosser, whose idea to put a show on in place of Carson, they thought they could make more money instead of the Best, and no one bothered us. And Dick Ebersole, who is the NBC executive assigned to the show, worked with Lorne. He's now head of sports and news, I think. So he's doing fairly well.
Mm-hmm.
He was the guy who kept the network away from us. So when George Carlin, who was the host of the first show, did his opening monologue, we got 200 calls because there was a little racy, as I call it, stuff in there.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy who was head of NBC at the time, Marvin Antonowski, said, I'm going to pull the plug, meaning take the show off the air. I said, stop being an idiot. You haven't gotten 200 calls in 20 years. You have a hit.
Now,
you know how executives are when you do something different.
Yes. Very, very, you know, anything that challenges the status quo, people go, hey, hold on a second. That's not what we bargained for.
Here's what I think about research, okay? I know you didn't ask me, but it goes with this conversation.
No, please.
The research after the first Saturday Night Live show was get rid of John Belushi, who was gross. The research on the Muppet Show was a frog can't host the show. That, you know what I think of research.
I agree with you 100%. Let's talk about Belushi for a second.
Well,
let's stick with Saturday Night Live in that first year. Because the show was a hit with the audience that it wanted to attract almost immediately, how far into that first season did ego become a problem?
Well, it was really Chevy the first year. You know, it was only Chevy who said, I'm Chevy Chase, and you're not.
Mm-hmm.
So he was the only one who mentioned his name. There were no agents around the show. There were no managers. There were no lawyers. None of the people had managers. That's why I got them all as clients.
Mm-hmm.
They thought because I represented Lorne, I was very smart, which is really rather good thinking if you come to think of it. And so they all came with me. The ego really didn't start till March of that year. Of the first year, because they went to the White House and they got a lot of publicity, and basically Chevy got most of it.
Mm-hmm.
Then Chevy decided to leave at the beginning of the second year, which was a break for the show, although I love Chevy, because Bill Murray got on. And Belushi had more time, and Danny had more time, and Gilda had more time. You must remember Chevy was hired as a writer, not as a performer.
Mm-hmm.
So he wrote a lot for himself. So it was, the ego really came in when, after Chevy left the show in 1978 when John did Animal House.
Yep.
And then when it came out in the summer of 79, all hell broke loose. Because here was John, this huge movie star, and everyone now was around the show, agents, managers, promising money. I made a great deal for John at Universal. And then John had to come back to the show and be that little $800 a week player. It wasn't a terrific time.
It's the Big 550 KTRS. I'm Paul Harris talking with Bernie Brillstein, legendary Hollywood agent and manager. And they were making $800 a week on Saturday
Correct.
Night Live?
You bet.
And he goes off and he makes a movie called Animal House, which breaks...
He made $35,000 for that movie.
He makes $35,000 for that and comes back and wants to talk, I'm sure, about making a better deal for the next year. But you represented Belushi, Aykroyd, et cetera.
And Lorne.
And Lorne. So how do you handle that when you've got both sides and they're all under your umbrella?
I know this is going to be shocking in show business. How about with honesty? I told everyone everything. And at the end of the fourth year, Lorne decided... to let Danny and John go to make Blues Brothers because they could make a lot of money and they were very passionate about it.
Mm-hmm.
Lorne had other people, and the pressure of that first group of people really hit its stride in the fifth year. Danny and John were huge stars. Gilda was a huge star. Bill was becoming a huge star. And so the tensions kept adding up because Lorne tried to keep some control, but here was everyone nipping at these people who had never been nipped at before and offering them large sums of money and the glamour, and I put that in quotes, of Hollywood.
How close do you get to people in a situation like
that? You're married to them. I mean, if you're a good manager, you have two lives, your personal life at home with your wife and family, and the life of the client. And all you have to do, well, maybe you have to do it in a marriage, too, is sublimate your ego to make it work.
So could you see Belushi destroying himself?
No. I mean, in retrospect, you say, sure, you should have seen it. In 1979 to 82, when he really started going on some kind of tear, I would say to him, John, you're really getting a little out of control. Now, remember, I was 46 years old then. I wasn't really aware of what these drugs were, nor was the rest of America. Maybe I missed it because I was older, but I used to say to John, now come on, be a good boy, because he used to disappear for a night.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd say, Bernie, I have the heart of a high school senior. Nothing's going to happen to me.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, he'd say, look, you take care of me from 8 in the morning till 6 at night. After that, my life is my own. And third of all, as we've all found out in America, you cannot commit someone to get help. They have to commit themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you say, bodyguards can't keep up. We had two bodyguards for John. You can't keep up with them. When they want to disappear, they disappear. Now, when Bob Woodward wrote the book, he wrote it from the perspective of, everyone in Hollywood knew that John was killing himself. I swear to you, no one knew. We loved him. I loved him especially. Why would I let himself kill him, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I had taken him to a doctor when he fell off a plane making 1941, and he wouldn't let the doctor put a needle in his knee. So why would I ever think he would do drugs worse than cocaine or put something in his arm? I mean, it was so foreign to me. Only, you know, Frank Sinatra did Man with the Golden Arm. That's as much as I knew about drugs.
Mm-hmm. You were there with the body flying to the funeral. I mean, I just wanted my listeners to get an idea of how close you were to Belushi and all these other people. What kind of shockwave did Belushi's death send through his contemporaries?
None.
They didn't wise up at all?
Hold it. I shouldn't say that. Arbitrarily. When you lose a friend, you're shocked. When you lose a young man, 33, you're shocked. When he dies of drugs, you're shocked. When you hear the coroner, Noguchi, out here say he died of a speedball, which is a combination of cocaine and heroin injected, you're really shocked, and you have non-belief. Then you get angry that it happened to your friend, and you get angry that your friend destroyed himself. And then when you're sitting in the plane taking the body across the country, you really don't know what to do because it's only 2 days after he's died and you're taking one of your best friends to be buried at 33. And anyone who's buried a son or a child knows it's the worst thing in the world. So how is it? You know, it's terrible. But I don't believe that the entire cast swore off drugs. I don't believe America swore off drugs. I think it lasted 2 weeks like anything else.
Mm-hmm. All right,
that's too bad.
Let's turn to a happier subject, of which was Belushi's partner Aykroyd putting together a project called Ghostbusters, which I know you were also involved in.
Yeah.
What always has fascinated me about that is the fact that Dan Aykroyd let Bill Murray be the real star of that movie.
Well, it was originally written for John. And Dan was always John's muse, okay? But then Bill, you know, took that role and did it. And Dan has no ego. Dan is just a genius. He's probably the best writer I've ever encountered, the nicest guy, and probably the best straight man in the world. And he just wanted a good movie. And the fact that Bill Murray had the better role, what does he care? That's how Danny functions. Remember, he comes from Second City, so he's used to a collaborative effort.
When you put Ghostbusters together, was it your company that took these people and said, hey, I represent these people, they have this idea, we want to turn it into a movie? How does that process work?
What you did with Danny was stranger than anything else. Danny came to me. He walked into my office, told me the idea, and he knew I knew the buildings in New York because I was born in New York with the gargoyles and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And he describes the whole thing of Ghostbusters. You know, Abbott and Costello did Ghost Breakers. I mean, this is not... It wasn't a brand new idea, but the way Danny did it was brand new. And then, from behind his back, he pulled the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. And he said, the last scene is this guy walks through the city. Well, I got hysterical. And I also was in awe of Danny's brain. He had sketches. He had everything else. Then he said, Bernard, he said like that, I have a contract here where I'm selling you the rights for a dollar because I don't want to screw it up. And that's what happened.
So he pitches it to you, and then you take it and pitch it to the studio? And
no, I pitched it to his agent, Mike Ovitz, because he represented Bill Murray, Harold Ramis, Ivan Reitman, and Danny. And he put it all together, and we went to the studios and sold it, to Columbia and sold it.
Last thing I want to talk to you about today, Bernie, is stars who get in trouble and how you can rehabilitate their career. For instance... From what I understand, you're involved with getting Rob Lowe on this West Wing show.
Yes.
That is such a huge hit now on Wednesday nights on NBC.
Well, I think it's the best show. I think that, The Practice, and The Sopranos are the best shows on television.
They are. They are good
besides
television.
Besides Sex and the City, which I love personally. It's a great show.
But Rob was, there was a time in the 80s when Rob was a guy that Hollywood wouldn't touch. You know, he had
right.
that thing videotaping himself having sex with the girls at the Democratic Convention in Atlanta and then, you know, appearing with Snow White on the Academy Awards.
You're very smart because, honest to God, although this was, 10, 12 years ago he did the thing in Atlanta?
Yeah.
I don't think that's what hurt him as much as the appearance of Snow White on the Academy Awards. I mean, I think more producers said, oh, my God. And remember, Rob Lowe is one of the best-looking people in America. And the people in Hollywood particularly don't like men who are that good-looking.
Hmm.
And so they had an excuse not to use him. Rob, I'm the godfather of his children. He, his wife Cheryl, and Carrie, my wife, and myself are best friends. He's the nicest guy I know. He's now all of 35 years old. So he had a tough time for 8 years, but he took it like a gentleman. He just worked hard in small independent movies, and finally the script came along for West Wing, which, by the way, he had to read for like an unknown.
Wow.
And got the role, and he's now Rob Lowe again. Isn't that a great, that's a great story,
so,
I think.
So he rehabilitated his career with your help by basically going back and working hard and doing that sort of thing. But what if you have somebody like a Robert Downey Jr., who's
trouble,
yeah, his trouble is legal and drugs and all that sort of stuff. Can somebody like that have a rehabilitation of their career?
You know something? Here's what I feel. Robert Downey Jr. is an excessive personality. I can't ever make excuses for people who do drugs and kill the golden goose. You know, Robert Downey was born with a great talent, great looks, and he really is a great actor, okay?
Yep.
You throw that away for a little bit of cocaine is really, to me, crazy. Now, I'm not answering your question directly. I know this sounds crazy. I believe Robert Downey, if he gets straight when he comes out of jail, will have another chance at a career. Not because people love him, not because people say, oh, let's help him, because he's good. And there's not that many good actors. However, if he makes one little mistake, he'll never work again.
Bernie, give me one or two names of people who you know are up-and-coming stars-to-be whose names everybody will know in the next year or two.
There's one, Wayne Brady, who's on Whose Line Is It Anyway?
Yes.
I believe and he's my client, I really believe he's going to be as huge a star as Bill Cosby.
Wow.
Because his talent is that good, he's that smart, and that nice.
You got a big project you're working on for him right now?
Yes. Yes.
Can you tell?
You know, it's a variety show, believe it or not, with ABC. And there's another young man called Brandon Bolin, who no one has heard of.
No.
And he's just a comedy, dramatic actor. And he has a one-man show, like Whoopi Goldberg did, and like John Leguizamo did. But that's what I'm doing, you know. And also, right now, the Marty Short Show, which I love.
Right. Well, we'll keep our eye out for Brandon Bolin, was his name?
Yeah, B-O-W-L-I-N. And maybe if you mark it down a year from today, call me and see what happens.
I'm going to do that.
That would be great.
And Wayne Brady as well. Good luck with the book. It's called Where Did I Go Right? You're No One in Hollywood Unless Someone Wants You Dead. Bernie Brylstein, thank you for your time today.
Thanks
I appreciate
for your
it.
Time.
I'm Paul Harris, and I'll take a break here, and we'll come right back on the Big 550 KTRS.